Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
You studied something and you studied it and studied it and studied it, and the more you knew, the more you know you didn't really know, but the more you knew what it wasn't. You know what I'm talking about? That's the way I think about the 11th chapter of Daniel. I'm not sure what it is. I think I'm pretty sure what it's not. And the more I study it, the more I don't know what it is. So I come with that kind of an attitude to you. As you remember, the last two chapters, chapter 10 was an introduction to chapter 11, which really is the main prophecy involved in all the book of Daniel. Everything points to this, or if you want another way, this is the culmination of all the rest of the book. It begins in the image of chapter 2 with the head of gold and on down bronze and silver and iron and clay. And then we saw it, we had a period of there where we talked about Daniel and the three children and all their exploits. Then we came to 7, which dealt again with the beast, and then 8 with a different set of beasts. And then we came to right on down the line as Daniel began to take this prophecy of what was going to happen on these kingdoms in the future and take one or two at a time and describe in detail. And all through the book, we have seen that Daniel has been focusing in on a particular period, and he focuses in on chapter 7 and then he backs off. And he focuses again in chapter 8, and he backs off, and he gets the wider expanse. Well, in chapter 11, he's focused in as clearly and as minutely and as detailed as anywhere in the Word of God. The prophecy here is almost a blow-by-blow account between the kingdoms of the Ptolemies and the kingdom of the Seleucids, or Egypt and Syria. Now, as you remember, last time we talked about this, we got so involved in Ptolemy the second and Seleucid the 1392nd and a million people. Well, there's no other way to handle the first part of this chapter 11. Now, the second part of chapter 11 is going to deal with an even more limited period of time, but it's the period of time that Daniel has been focusing in on. It's the person that we have mentioned several times, and I want to know if you know who it is. Starts with an A. Antiochus the fourth Epiphanes. Okay. Now, he is the one that Daniel comes back to and back to. Now, the reason he comes back to and back to him is because he is the one that gave the people of God the most trouble. And of course, Daniel is concerned with the country of Israel. He doesn't mention the wars in Babylon. He doesn't mention the wars in Greece. He doesn't mention the wars over in Spain. He focuses on that little area of land called the Promised Land, and the whole book of Daniel is kind of what's happening in history for this little land. Now, one thing it says to me, above and beyond all else, is that God knows what's going to happen. I believe in predictive prophecy. I don't think that God so much determines every step we take, as I believe that God is a creature beyond time. And by being beyond time, he is not controlled by the past, the present, and the future as we are, and it's very hard for us to understand that. Simply to say that God knows what's going to happen without necessarily causing, determining, forcing it to happen. And that's what I think we have involved right here. Now, as we focus in chapter 11, verse 21 is, I believe, the beginning of a new paragraph. And I'm going to read verse 21 through 45. Now, I need to ask you a question before I do. And by asking the question, I'm going to give it away, but I don't see any way to ask it. We've gone through all these different kings, and the king of the south and the king of the north, and it's switched back and forth from one kind of Ptolemy to another and one kind of Seleucid to another. Now, in verse 21, I'm just going to tell you that it begins, either verse 21 begins to talk about the Antichrist, or it begins to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth. And maybe it's a good place to tell you the other theories, and you try to filter in your mind. The other people they thought have been talked about in verse 21 and following is Constantine the Great, Omar Ibn el-Khattab. For those of you who don't know interbiblical history, that's just a real tongue tire, but he was one of the rebellious people who lived in Palestine and rebelled against Roman authority. Some think it's the papal system, the Roman Catholic Church. Some think it's the little horn of Daniel 7. Some think it's Herod the Great. Some think it's the Antichrist. Some are quite sure it's Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth. I'm quite sure that nobody knows who it is except God, and he's not talking.
So what we're going to do here is try to go through this and see if we can, the positive, the negative, about who is talked about here and why. And that's all I know how to do to handle it. So let's read. I want to ask one more question. When we read through this, I want you to tell me, very honestly, if you think there is a change of subject in verse 36. When we read through it, you tell me as we read through it, if you think there's a change of subject in verse 36. Okay, let's start at verse 21. And in his place a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. And after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors, but he will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them. And he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war. But he will not stand, for the schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choicest food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. And he'll return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. At the appointed time he will return and come into the south, but this last time will not turn out the way it did before. For the ships of Kittim, it can be C-H or K, I think Kittim is probably better, will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. The forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. And by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. And they will fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and he will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. And he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know, and he will honor him with gold and silver and costly stones and treasures. And he will take action against the strongest of the fortresses, and with the help of a foreign god, he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and will cause them to rule over many, and will parcel out land for a price. And at the end of time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and horsemen and many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall. And these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. And he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. And he will pitch tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Very clear, right? Obvious who he's talking about, right? This is not obvious for nothing. Now, all I know to do is to go through this on the way I usually do, by taking certain words, by commenting on certain passages, by trying to fit in what I think will fit, and by commenting on what I believe will not fit, and then come back in the end to have a discussion time. Now, this is the epitome or focal point or object of all the book of Daniel. Now, the rest of the book of Daniel has been seemingly confined, for the most part, to the age when the Roman Empire will begin and will be crushed. That possibly is not true in chapter 7, verses 24 and 27, which deal, many believe, with the Antichrist. And I think that is absolutely correct. And therefore, it deals with the end time. And by the end time, I mean very close to the coming of the Son of Man again. And so, I think that you have to take that into context when you look. Now, who is the person that's called a despicable person in verse 21? There is no question here who this person has got to be. The question is, does this person epitomize the forces or the attitude of the Antichrist? Does this person go from verse 31 through verse 45, or is there a change of subject at verse 36? Obviously, to me at least, the person beginning in verse 21 is not the Antichrist yet. It is Antiochus Epiphanes. It fits perfectly into secular history up until verse 36. Now, if you see, it says that the honor of kingship has not been confirmed on him. He was not the rightful heir to the throne when Seleucid IV died. The rightful heir was his son, Seleucid IV's son, called Demetrius Soter. And he was just a boy. If you know anything about history this time, Antiochus Epiphanes IV was in Rome because the Seleucids got beaten so bad with the Romans that they took some of the people that were very prominent back to Rome as hostages. And just before Seleucid IV died, he asked Rome to trade his son Demetrius for Antiochus IV because he wanted Antiochus IV back home. The Romans let Antiochus IV go. He went to Athens. And on his way back to the kingdom of Syria, his brother, who was the king, died. Now, the heir apparent was in Rome captive. So Antiochus IV came back and played like he was going to be the guardian of the young son. But then the young son was killed by a man named Andronius. And therefore, it looked like a plot, but Antiochus IV killed the man who killed the rightful heir and looked like he was the great hero. Anyway, he got the throne, but he was not the rightful heir. And that's apparently what it refers to here. When it says he did it at a time of tranquility and seized the kingdom by intrigue, it's exactly what happened. There was no war. It was done by undercover kind of policies. Now, you see in verse 22 where it says, "And overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant." Now, what we've got in verse 22 down through about 25 is the war that continued between Egypt and Syria, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And there are several campaigns in the life of Antiochus IV. Now, first of all, he went down there to Egypt, and he just almost took over the whole country, but he couldn't take Alexandria because it was too well fortified. So he came back, but he had all kinds of money and possessions with him. And when he came back through Israel, because that's the natural way to go through, he killed the prince of the covenant. Now, who that is, we don't know exactly. Many think that it's a man named Onias III. And it may very well be, we just don't know. But we think it was probably the high priest at this time. Now, you see where it says in verse 23, "And he will go up and gain power with a small force of people." And on down there in verse 27, it says, "And they speak lies to one another." This is the political intrigue between I forgot what Ptolemy it is. I think it's Philopater or Philopater or one of them, and this Antiochus. And they tried to flatter each other because, you see, there was two heirs in Egypt, and Antiochus picked one, and he was going to help one come to the throne, and they threw big banquets and parties and were kind of wooing each other. And what this whole thing talks about is that Jerome, you know who Jerome is? He's the one who translated the Vulgate, the Roman Catholic Latin version from the Greek and Hebrew. He lived about 300 A.D. He thought this little word "going up" refers to going up the Nile to gain power. But there's a big, long intrigue in here, and there's a whole lot of things happened. I don't think Well, let me just go through part of it again. You see the king of the, you see the richest part of his realm there in verse 24? This thing can, I think, can be two things. It can be one, that he went to Egypt and plundered Egypt, or number two, he went to the richest parts of his own kingdom to have more taxes. Now, when Rome defeated Syria, it demanded several things. Number one, it took all of Asia Minor from them, except Sicily, I guess, and another little province there. It charged them a huge amount of taxation, and it had them give these 20 prisoners as hostages. Well, because of this huge taxation, and the Seleucid kings began to rob the temples in their provinces and take the money out of the temples. Really, I don't think Antiochus hated Jews so much as Antiochus had to have that money in the temple in Jerusalem to pay the Romans. And so this idea about the richest part of his realm, I don't think personally refers to Egypt. I think it refers to the increased taxation that Antiochus IV had to put on his own people because of this Roman problem. Now, you see that in verse 25 where it says, "And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south." Now, the king of the south here has got to be Egypt. It can be nobody else. And notice the two large armies come together. And you see in verse 26 it says, "Those who eat his choicest food will destroy him." Now, we're talking about those who sat at the king's table. And we're not talking about Antiochus, we're talking about the Egyptian rulers. There was two brothers that were vying for the throne, and one brother, some people in his own organization, betrayed him, and the other guy became king. So it was a very political kind of thing, and this idea, those who ate the choicest food, means his closest friends and counselors betrayed one of these kings of Egypt. Now, they came together in verse 27, Antiochus and this guy who was left, and they just played like they were really being friends, and boy, things were going great, and all the time they were planning on taking each other's kingdom. It was just a Watergate deal all over. Now, you see there in verse 28 when it says, "And then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant." Now, this means on his way back through, he's going to be upset about something. I think probably that's about the money. And he stops off, and of course when it says the Holy Covenant, who's that referring to? Who? Who's the Holy Covenant? The Jews. Can't be anybody else, right? The Holy Covenant's got to be the Jewish people. So he stops off at the temple there and you know, really gives them a hard time. And now notice in verse 29. "At the appointed time he will return and come into the south. But the last time will not turn out the way it did the first, for the ships of Kittim." Now, in the Old Testament, Kittim is mentioned several times. It always refers to the people of the West or the people of the island of Cyprus. And here, I think, it refers to the Romans. Now, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, has the word Romans here instead of the word Kittim. Now, what happened, if you know your history, Antiochus IV marched through Palestine again to get to Egypt. He was going to take over Egypt. And a ship, a Roman ship, came with an ambassador on that ship. And he walked off right in front of the army and said, "Antiochus, the Roman Senate wishes you wouldn't take Egypt." And Antiochus started hee-hawing around. And this guy drew a circle around Antiochus IV and said, "You will answer me before you leave that circle, or you will go to war with Rome." And Antiochus threw a fit and ate his words and went back home. But he was mad as the devil, and he took it out against Palestine. When he came back through, it goes a little bit further. There had been a fight for the high priesthood in Israel. And a man had heard, the guy who wanted to be high priest, called Jason, had heard that Antiochus IV had died in battle. So when he heard Antiochus IV had died, him and 1,000 of his men took over the city of Jerusalem to make him high priest. And the high priest that was there then, called Malleus, went into the temple and hid. Well, when Antiochus IV came back and heard that Jason had revolted, well, he just took Jerusalem, and he just killed a bunch and destroyed a bunch and had all the gold taken out of the temple and just razed, knocked down the walls, the city, and everything. He was so upset. And you know what he was. He was mad at Rome and took it out on the Jews, exactly what happened. Now, you see where it talks about, you can just read that for yourself. In verse 31, you see what happened that's alluded to several times by Jesus Christ in Matthew 24 and Mark 13. And it says, "And for the forces with him will arise and desecrate." Now, I don't know what your Bible has. The word is sanctuary fortress. Now, Those are two nouns right together, and it sounds funny to us because I think for you to understand it in English, you ought to put a hyphen between sanctuary, fortress. And a better word for fortress that you might understand better would be refuge. That's what it's talking about. It's a name for the temple. And it's talking about the sanctuary and the spiritual refuge or fortress. It's not talking about a physical fortress, but the temple was built kind of like a fort. But it means the sanctuary refuge of the people of God. Well, they went there and they did away. Remember back over there in verse 8 and 9, we talked about a thing called the continuum or the continual. And we interpreted that as the regular morning and evening sacrifices and all. Well, what happened? They put a stop to all the regular feast days, to all the Sabbath observances, to the circumcision of children, to the special anything the Jews did. Anyone who had a copy of the law had to burn it. And it went so far that if a mother circumcised her child, the mother and all the family would be killed. And they put up pagan altars all over the country. And they went into the temple area, knocked over the brazen altar, and put a altar to Zeus Olympus, which is the family god of Antiochus and the Seleucids, right in the temple. And that just blew the Jews' mind. Well, you can imagine. Here's God's temple, and here's a statue to Zeus right where the brazen altar should be. And so that's what I think is called the abomination of desolation in verse 31. A little bit later on, Antiochus had on this very altar in Jerusalem, he had a pig sacrificed there. Now, of all the places that you just don't want to have a pig sacrificed is in the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, and you sure don't want to have it sacrificed to Zeus Olympus. So you can imagine why the Jews revolted. They just couldn't stand that. It was just the epitome of a sacrilege to them. Now, in verse 32, you get the character of this guy. He was a smooth talker, a tricker. He sent a man down there to talk to the people at Jerusalem, and he said, "Well, we want to talk to you, and we've got to have to increase the tax a little bit." So he got inside the city with his men, and on the Sabbath day, when no loyal Jew would fight or run or anything, they just wiped the city out. Killed everybody, took slaves, tore down the walls, and just a really bad deal. And it all was done by this subtle kind of trickery, like, we're going to do this and that, and in the last minute, just stuck a knife in them. So, now, you see where it talks about in verse 34, and they will fall. Well, let's move back a little bit. Notice that here it says, and those who have insight among the people will give understanding to many, and they will fall by the sword and by famine and by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now, who is the they will refer to? Can you follow? Who is the they will there? Verse 33. Faithful Jews, those who had the true worship of God, the true understanding, they're the ones who are going to die. Now, you notice it says in verse 34, now they will fall, and they will be granted a little help, and many will join them in hypocrisy. Now, they will is a future tense, and therefore, I think this is the only reference in all the Bible to guess who? Who was the little help that came? Who was the man, the biggie? During this time for the Jews, Judas Maccabeus. He completely overthrew the Assyrian domination and gave freedom back to Israel for a while. Do you know that every time that you have Christmas and your Jewish friends have a thing called Hanukkah? Do you know what Hanukkah is? It's the Feast of Lights. And the Feast of Lights that happened in 168, December 25th, is the opening or the cleansing of the temple in Jerusalem by the forces, those revolutionary forces under Maccabeus that reinstituted the sacrificial system again. So that's what they, every time you have a Christmas, they're observing the temple being reopened and the sacrifices being started again under the Maccabeans. And it's a beautiful thing to them. Now, you see in verse 30, see what it says, that many will join them in hypocrisy. As you know, many of the Jews were apostates and went after this Hellenistic culture, but when they saw the Maccabeans winning, they said, "Well, we were really always on your side anyway." "Yes, sir, we don't like those old Greeks either. We want to join you." And so many kind of people who didn't have the same sense of loyalty and nationality that the Maccabeans had joined the cause. It got so bad that there was a gymnasium built in Jerusalem. And as you know, women couldn't go. It was only for the men. And the men practiced in the nude, and they ran their races and did their weightlifting and all in the nude. And so the Jews were embarrassed because they were circumcised. So they invented an operation so a man could have an operation where he would not look circumcised anymore. Well, you can imagine what that did to the faithful Jews. They threw a fit. And that's just one of the examples of what was happening in this time, in this attempt by Antiochus to Hellenize the Jews. Now, you see in verse 35, I think it's a real key here for something that was meaningful to my life. And some of those who have insight will fall in order that, or for the purpose to, refine, purge, and make pure. Now, may I ask you a question? What is the purpose of trials and temptations in the Christian life? God just wants to sock it to you? Doesn't like you too happy, wants you to be a little miserable? I think we could almost say to refine, to purge, and to make pure, couldn't we? Trials have a purpose, and God apparently allowed this to happen to his people here, that they might, their faith might be strengthened, that the dross of their lives might be burnt out. It might become more and more like what God wanted them to be. And so I think in your life sometimes the things we go through may be something that God is using to make us more in the image of his Son. Now, in verse 36, when I read through this, did you pick up a change of subject? Now, tell me the truth. Don't tell me what you think I want to hear. Tell me the truth. Did you pick up a change of subject? I don't think you did you? If you did, you're a lot sharper person than everybody I know about. Now, why do we want to make a change of subject in verse 36? A little grammatical point. Some say it says the king. Well, that seems very flimsy to make a change of subject on. Some say it says, and this will be the point to the end time, and there shows a transition. The reason that I have to make a change of subject in my interpretation of the 11th chapter of Daniel is because 36 on does not fit the life of Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Many people have rejected the book of Daniel and say it's written by a man during the Maccabean period because they say the rest of this is so accurate history and this is so faulty history that what you've got is a man writing during the days of Antiochus the Fourth, and he can write what's already happened as if it hadn't happened, but he's writing it so accurate. But he didn't know about Antiochus dying over in Babylon, so he just wrote about this, and it was just kind of a make-believe kind of thing in this last part. And so the rest is just history, and this is fabrication. Now, friends, there are people who believe that about the book of Daniel, that the book of Daniel is written in the Maccabean period and not by the person Daniel who lived back in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Now, to me, that is abhorrent to me, to think that the Bible includes something that's false in the sense of just pure fraud. I don't care how pious or how meaningful it was or how needed it was. To me, to say that an angel said, when somebody, not even Daniel, is saying it, to me is a lie, and God doesn't work in that manner, okay? So, if it completely doesn't fit the rest of Antiochus' life, you've got to have a change of subject in verse 36, or you've got great problems with the text of Daniel. Now, first of all, let's talk about who the change of subject can be. Now, most everybody starts throwing people up, and we say, oh, that's much a bull, but if you look at their lives, you'd see some affinities. They say Herod the Great. You say, well, how does that fit, Herod the Great? Well, number one, he didn't follow the worship of his fathers. His father was an Edomian, right? He became Jewish. He was circumcised by force by a man named John Hyrcanus, who was the high priest then. So you got Herod the Great fit to some extent. Constantine the Great is the one that is put forward by Jewish interpreters, because they sure don't like Constantine, because he was the beginning of the real persecution for the Jews. And then a person like Luther, Martin Luther. You know who Martin Luther thinks it was? Who do you think Martin Luther would make the Antichrist or make these people? Just think, who? The Roman Church, huh? Sure, and you say, that doesn't fit. Well, he said they despise women, they won't get married, you see, that fit. And they were after gold and money and silver, and well, that fits pretty much, you know, the history of the Roman Catholic Church early. And then they say stuff like, well, they were political and they came with large forces. That describes the Roman Catholic Church early as a political kind of thing. It fits real well, parts of it. Guess who Calvin thought it was? John Calvin, another reformer, thought it was the whole system of Roman government, the nation of Rome. And it fits very well, the nation of Rome. But to me, the very change of subject here, when it doesn't seem like a change of subject, is a very dubious interpretation to just stick somebody in. How many of you have heard the interpretations that Hitler was the one that's all this talking about? You ever heard somebody say that? How many of you heard in the last couple of years that Kissinger is the one? Okay, now you see what we're doing? Do you see what we're doing? What did Luther do in his day? What did the Jews do in their day? We stuck in the people that our own historical context says. Don't you see? So that says to me, be careful here. Now what we've got, if you read right through, it seems like we haven't changed subjects. So what I want to talk to you about is the way the Bible seems to use historical situations and how it has a telephoto lens, if you please. And it zooms in from historical to the end of the world and zooms back in just like that. You say it, don't believe it. It happens all through Isaiah, all through Jeremiah, all through Ezekiel, all through Amos and Hosea, all through Malachi, all through Zechariah, all through Obadiah and Habakkuk and all the rest. A local situation is zoomed in on as being the final situation of the world. You know what I'm talking about? Somebody will come and destroy a bunch of people and there'll be fear and they'll say, and this is what it's going to be like at the end of the world. And so they'll zoom from the historical to the end and they'll zoom back. We would like to call it multiple fulfillment of prophecy, but I think better, it's this fuzziness between the historical here and now and the one day coming. Now, do you catch we're doing the same thing with Hitler and Kissinger? You see what we're doing? We're taking our local existential situation and saying, ours is the end time. Ours is the last day. We're living in the day of prophecy, and so we focus the end right up to us. Now, you might like that, but I just want to say that everybody since a man named Porphyry has been doing that. Everybody has thought that their age was the last days. Everybody has thought their particular problem is the Antichrist. So that little red light goes off my head, Utley, don't do it in your day. Don't stick it on somebody today because everybody in the past has done it. And what we got to watch is that it's every crisis we go through is in some way like the great last crisis going to come at the end of the day. So what we have here is someone who if I had a choice, I'd make them the Antichrist. Now, my problem with that is that it seems like, if you just read it, we're talking about something that happened in whose day? In Titus's, right? The context seems to say it's somebody that happens right during the time of Antiochus the Fourth, right at the beginning of the power of Rome, right at the coming of the Savior. The whole context about the land of Egypt, land of Moab, and the beautiful land, the chariots and horsemen, seemed to say it happened back then. Now, if it is a prophecy of the end time, then what we have is the end symbolized in terms of the present. Now, do you think the Antichrist is going to come with horses and chariots and trimarines? Probably not. He's going to come with the armaments of his day, right? Now, why do they have to use ships and horsemen and chariots? Because that's all they understood. So what we have here, I believe, is a figurative language trying to describe what's going to happen in the last days. But it's very specific. It doesn't fit anything we know. Okay, now let's look. And I just want to show you where some of these problems fall in. The king, I think, can be identified with the Antichrist. Some say it's got to be Antiochus. Now, let me show you why it can't be Antiochus. You say, well, he magnified himself above God, and he spoke monstrous things, and he did all these things in the temple. Okay? Now, this is where 2 Thessalonians 2:4 gets the description of the man of lawlessness. Okay? And 2 Thessalonians 2:4 is a description of the last days and the Antichrist that will come at the end of the time and be problems and all kinds of things happening. This is where he gets it from. But that's not unusual, for Paul and Jesus and all the rest of them got all their language from the Old Testament, didn't they? About the coming in the clouds of heaven and all that. So it's not unusual. They got it right here. So you say, well, that proves it's got to be the Antichrist. No, I don't think it does. I think it lends support to it. Now, you see in verse 37 where it says, and he will show no regards for the gods, nor regard for the gods of his father. Does that fit in Titus Epiphanes the Fourth? It does not. This is the most embarrassing phrase for all those people who want to say all this was fulfilled in Antiochus' day. Well, the problem is Antiochus followed the tradition of his fathers. They worshipped a man or a god called Zeus Olympus. And that's exactly the person that Antiochus worshipped. So it doesn't fit there. Then it says he'll have no desire for women. Now, what does that mean? Well, we don't know what it means exactly. All we can do is make conjecture about it. It's the plural. It's not one woman. It's the plural. Has no desire for women. So it may be that what it's saying is he has no natural kind of human desire. He doesn't have a desire to love his mother or his sister. And he has no desire for a wife or children. It may say, number one, he has no regard for tradition. The gods of his fathers could care less about that. He has no regard for human personal interrelationship, like the closest is the family. He has no regard to that. And then finally it says he has no regard for any other gods, which means he has no regard for tradition, no regard for human relationships, and no regard for religion. He's got a pretty independent cuss, isn't he? Now, notice when it says, and look at verse 37 and look at verse 38. If you don't see an inconsistency there, you're not looking. It says he regards no God. He doesn't know. He doesn't recognize the God of his fathers. He doesn't even look to any other God. Bang! Verse 38. Look what it says. But instead, he will honor the God of fortresses. Now, I don't know what translation you got, but it got into here real quick to translate this by the name, the Greek name, Hebrew name here, and it's a name that I think you spell it M-I-Z-Z-A-I-N. Something real close to that. M-A-U. Okay. That's an English-sized deal, but it's real close. So, Jerome was the first to do it. Theodosian did it. They just put this name in here as if this was a God's proper name. And many thought, because it's the God of war, that it's got to be the God of Mars. And you know why Luther put this name in here like you have it in your translation? Because the Latin name for mass is very close to this Hebrew name for fortresses. And Luther thought this is a reference to the Mass, and therefore he put it right in the text. Now, do you see the presupposition there? Luther knew in his heart that this guy was the Pope, the papal system, and therefore what does he do? Sees a word looks like Mass, and just says, obviously this is referring to the Mass. Well, there's no way in the world this refers to the Mass. None. And the Hebrew word here that you have transliterated into English there means the fortresses. And so I think, instead of having the God with such a proper name, because it says he knew no other God. He didn't regard any God. He didn't care about religion. He just cared about himself. So it doesn't fit that he worshiped a God, does it? Now, I think what it's saying is that he went bananas over warfare. He always thought about the God of fortresses or fighting or taking strongholds or always being in battle or who can I kill tomorrow? Where can I fight next week? You see? He was possessed by fighting. Now you say, was that fit? I think it fits very well. Now, when it says a God whom his father did not know, obviously, but it says he will honor him with gold and silver and costly stones and treasures. Do you honor a God of war with gold and silver and costly stones and treasures? So what does that mean? Well, here's the big problem in interpreting a chapter like this. Do you take everything literally? You can't. You just can't. You can't take ships and chariots and that literally if it's going to be the Antichrist. And you can't take gold and silver and all that if you don't have an idol. You just got an ambition, a war ambition. So you say, well, I'm going to take it literally. Well, you can't. You can't. It's either got to be symbolic or it's talking about somebody in Antiochus the fourth day. If it's the Antichrist, it can't be taken literally. It's got to be symbolic of another age, way off. Now, you see where it talks about down here? Look at verse 39. And he will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of what? But this guy didn't know gods. Well, he didn't know. It didn't worship gods. It's got to be this idea of war and not a definite God, because it will not fit. If you just read 37, it won't fit if you interpret 38 and 39 as a specific God, like the English translation that has that proper name there. And just look for yourself. I think it's obvious. Now, verse 40, what have we got? Well, we got at the end time. Now, I'm going to go about 5 minutes over, but I cannot stop here. I'm not coming back next week on this. It's just, every time I stop for a week, I know it blows your mind, because I forget all these names, and I know you do too. And so, at the end time, I've said that with you now at least 5 times in Daniel. What does the end time mean or does not mean? How do you know what it means? Oh, please answer. Where do you look to see what the specific phrase, the end time, means? You look at the New Testament. What do you do to know what the end time means? It could be, Don. That's one interpretation. And I think personally that is my interpretation, but where did you get that? That's what I'm asking you. New Testament. Okay, so that's what I'm talking about. Can or is it legitimate to take the meaning of the word in the New Testament and apply it every time the word appears back in the Old Testament? No. The only way to know what the little phrase, the latter days, or the end time, or the day of the Lord, means in the Old Testament is a little principle of interpretation called what? Context. You can't know what it means until you read the chapter in which it's written. Now, in the earlier part of chapter 11, the end time means the time of the death of Antiochus the Fourth. Doesn't mean that here, though, does it? If this is somebody contemporaneous with Antiochus, it means back in that day. If it's talking about the Antichrist, it means what? The second coming. So you've got to look at the context. It doesn't always mean the same thing. Now, at the end of days, the king of the south, that's got to be what? Egypt? Got to be Egypt. Will collide with him, the king of the north, and will storm against with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he will enter countries and overflow them. Now, you say, well, if this is the Antichrist, how do you know it's Syria and Egypt? Good question. You say, yeah, but Bob, you just told me up there in verse so-and-so that the king of the south meant Egypt and the king of the north meant Syria, and now you're changing it? That's exactly what I'm doing. Do you understand why I'm doing it? I'm doing it on a set of presuppositions. It will not fit historically from 36 on. If it will not fit historically, you've got a problem with the text. We don't understand what it means at all. Or you've got to change subjects. If you change subjects, that means the king of the south does not automatically refer to Egypt, and the king of the north does not automatically refer to Syria. So it's talking about a wider range of people. Now, I think one of the real problems in interpreting prophecy is that everybody wants to be so dadgum literalistic. If it says Egypt here, it's got to always mean Egypt, and therefore what we've got in the last days is a fight between Egypt and Syria. And a good way to know that can't last is the word Moab. You see it in verse 41? It says Edom and Moab and the sons of Ammon. There's only one problem with it, Moab. It hasn't existed for hundreds of years, and it has never existed since. You say, well, Moab has got to be reconstituted a country before the Lord can come back, right? Baloney. These are symbolic ways of talking about world forces. I don't know if Egypt's going to be involved in the last fight. I don't know what the king of the north means. I believe it's going to be a terrible kind of confrontation. I don't know where it's going to be. I don't know when it's going to be. But I guarantee you one thing, I don't think Moab's going to be there. You see what I'm saying? If you say it's got to be literally, absolutely fulfilled, I don't think you can get it done. If that's true, then the last battle of history is going to be done with chariots and spears and bows and arrows. You believe that? The bows and spears and chariots have got to be symbolic for the fighting equipment of that day, right? Whatever it may be it tanks, be it tactical nuclear weapons. It was the fighting equipment that day, and if this is referring to the end time, you can't say, but I want it literally, unless you got bows and arrows and chariots in the last battle. Now, some folks go to all kind of lengths to tell you how all the ball bearings in the world are going to fall together and fall apart, and the tanks won't run, the planes won't fly, and the guns won't shoot, going to get spears and arrows and run on the horses and kill each other. So be it. Now, you see where it says the beautiful land in verse 41, that's got to be Israel? You see where it says, notice down there the land of Egypt and the Libyans and the Ethiopians. Does that mean that Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia are going to be in the last battle? Well, I think again it's talking about forces that are going to come together here, and not so much those particular kind of forces. Now, you see the word annihilate in verse 44? Do you have annihilate in your translation, the last word almost? Annihilate many. What word do you have there? Destroy. This is a very unusual Hebrew word. It's a Hebrew word that means devoted to destruction. Remember why it was that Achan couldn't take anything out of Jericho when Jericho fell? Why was it? Right, and the word they use there is korban, which means totally dedicated to God. Therefore, you couldn't take anything. It was all his. And he did. This is the same word. It means totally devoted to God. And the idea there is for destruction. Now, how that fits in here, I do not know, but that's the Hebrew word there. Now, you see where it says, he will pitch his tents in the royal pavilion and the seas and the beautiful mountain. Now, the seas is what? Well, some say it's a Dead Sea, but really the word Dead Sea is never used like this. It's got to be the Mediterranean Sea. And the beautiful holy mountain's got to be what? It's got to be Mount Zion. It's got to be the temple. So you got, and if this is Antiochus Epiphanes, you've got him in the promised land when he dies. But Antiochus didn't die in the promised land. He died over in Babylon. Now, does this mean the last days there's going to be a huge war somewhere around Jerusalem? Well, it seems to be that there are several texts that seem to point to that. There are some in Ezekiel. There are some in Zechariah. There are some apparently here, that there's going to be a confrontation of forces in the last day somewhere in the promised land. How, who, where, when, I don't know. But I think what we've got here is the Antichrist. Now, sorry about that, folks. It's the best I can do with this chapter. Wish I could do better. Wish I had all the answers. I don't.